All right, here we are, Fighter Pilot Professor, the latest episode. Today we're going to be talking a little bit about NATO and what's the deal with NATO and what's it up to. And then we'll talk about, why do I talk about failure so much? It seems that if you're a fighter pilot, you should win a lot. And I do. But also failure is part of the thing, so we'll talk a little bit about that. Hope you enjoy. We'll dive right in. So recently, former President Trump got himself in a little bit of a controversy, we'll say, around discussions about NATO, which brought up a lot of questions, folks, to me about what does he mean by all this, and what is NATO about, and how does it work, and why is there so much consternation around it? So, sort of simplifying it a little bit, the short story is NATO was formed in 1949, and we've talked a little bit about the post-World War II world order. And so NATO is largely a part of that post-World War II world order. It was formed in response to the threat of the Soviet expansion. At the end of World War II, the Soviets did not disband or demilitarize their military like most other nations did. Additionally, they did not withdraw their military completely or even partially from the areas that they occupied at the end of World War II. So nations like Poland, Hungary, parts of Germany, etc. While the United States and France and Great Britain, etc., kept parts of their military in Germany as part of an occupation force, they largely demobilized their militaries and brought them back home. The Soviets, on the other hand, did not do that. And the Western nations quickly realized that if the Soviets decided to do so, they had a ready, prepared numerical advantage, and they could just basically take over the rest of Western Europe if they so desired. And so in response, no one nation had the wherewithal or the political will or, frankly, the economic power to build an army big enough to hold back the Soviet Red Army. And so the idea was, if we band together, then we can help stop the expansion of Soviet communism, particularly in Western Europe. And so that was the original construct of NATO. Obviously, after the Soviet Union fell, that construct sort of came under scrutiny. But as the 90s went along, NATO became involved in conflicts in the Balkans. And then after September 11, 2001, was actually the first time that NATO enacted what's called Article 5. Article 5 is the mutual defense part of the NATO founding documents. And this Article 5 clause states that an attack against one NATO nation is considered an attack against all of them. And so they should respond accordingly. Now, here's where the interesting parts of NATO come into play. And I've had the opportunity to serve as an American representative in NATO, and it's an interesting place. But everything in NATO is A, voluntary, and B, every decision in NATO is made through consent. In other words, every nation either has to consent or at least abstain before NATO takes action. In other words, if there's any no's, then NATO cannot take, as a group, NATO cannot take action. And that's both on the political and the military side. NATO has both political and military sides. So that's one unique part. So even if Article 5 is invoked, as it was after September 11, 2001, for the first time in NATO history, the nations involved, A, had to vote in favor of it or at least abstain, and then B, they could or could not voluntarily participate in the operations in Afghanistan in order to carry out this self-defense clause after the September 11th attacks. That's one interesting part of NATO. The second part is, as they say within the command and within NATO, is the costs fall where they lay. In other words, each nation is responsible for bearing the brunt of costs for its own operations. In other words, the United States doesn't pay for Germany, Germany doesn't pay for Great Britain, et cetera, et cetera. Each nation pays its own way. So that kind of is where President Trump takes exception with NATO, is that the United States has a large contingent within the NATO command structure, both politically and military, and so the United States pays relatively speaking, pays a larger portion of the bill to support NATO operations. But that's because that is effectively an American operation, right? The other thing that President Trump took exception to was this idea of the 2% GDP contribution. And so this is not a binding thing for NATO nations, but more of a guideline. It's not actually payments to NATO. What it is each NATO nation agreed in 2006-ish to spend approximately 2.5% of its GDP on defense. Right. This was in response to the large withdrawal of defense spending after the fall of the Soviet Union in the 90s, and the United States included, NATO nations massively reduced their military spending. And this 2.5% was meant to be sort of a buffer, a guideline of spending towards supporting the NATO alliance through military power, right? And so this 2.5% is a guideline. It's not a rule, however. And so this, again, sort of is the unique nature of NATO in that if a nation is able to, they can spend, and some nations do. The United States has always been a contributor above the guideline. Most nations are right at the guideline, and there's a few below. So that's really the sort of stickiness of what goes on in NATO. It's a unique organization. It's an important one, in my opinion. And I think not a lot of people understand how it operates. Hope that's helpful, and keep sending me your questions. So somebody asked me recently, like, why do you talk about failing so much? I thought you were a fighter pilot, and fighter pilots are supposed to be winners. And you're right, we are. However, I do talk about failing a lot, and that's because, in my opinion, failure, losing, and lesson learning is part of the process of success. Frankly, you know, most people learn the most when they fail rather than when they succeed, because what happens is we tend to look at success as predetermined, or just, hey, this is what's supposed to happen when you carry along this path, right? But when you're doing hard things, that success is not predetermined, right? Like, it's not always going to fall your way. And so there's going to be times when you fall down. And so in my opinion, overcoming failure as part of the learning process on your path to success is as critical as being successful, right? And so while you may plan to succeed as you move along your path, frankly, you won't always, right? And if you think of it this way, right, if I want to learn to play the piano, and I don't play the piano, but if I wanted to learn to play the piano, I would not be very good at it at first, right? And I would have to learn, and I would have to practice, and I would have to put in effort, and I would fail at playing scales. Even the most basic part of playing the piano, I would fail at that, right? And so I'd have to relearn, reattempt, start back at the beginning, take the lessons of my failure, and build from there, right? And that's just a small part of what I'm talking about, right? Obviously, if you want to succeed in life, you want to, you know, go into law school, you want to be a fighter pilot, you want to whatever it is, right? Those kind of things means that along the way, hey, you're learning new things, and those new things that you're learning, frankly, are challenging at every step, right? And so if it's something totally new to you, especially, the odds of you being able to successfully complete it perfectly on the first attempt are really, really low. And so you have to learn to deal with failure. In the fighter pilot world, we talk about how we like introduce, practice, and then demonstrate proficiency in a task as part of flying an airplane, right? And so the first time that I demonstrate something to a new pilot, I'm just introducing it to them. They are never seen it before, potentially. They've never practiced it, and they're going to have to learn how to do it. And in fact, the first few times they do it, they're probably going to be terrible at it, right? Maybe even dangerous. So I, as the instructor, would have to coach them through it, would have to talk them through it, would have to talk through about what they did right and what they did wrong and what they need to improve, and et cetera, et cetera. then they need to go through a series of opportunities to practice it, right? And hopefully at each series of practice, they improve incrementally along the way, but there's still going to be failures before they finally do what we call demonstrate proficiency. In other words, they can finally complete this task successfully on their own without any inputs from me as their instructor, and they know how to do it at least a certain level of proficiency. Now, obviously, if you're going to be the best at something, which I strive to be, and I would imagine most people strive to be the best at something that they do, then that means that that level of proficiency is even higher and higher. And so my level of skill has to be elevated even more. And therefore, the opportunities for me to fail along the way are exponentially more likely, right? And so therefore, I talk about failing a lot because if you're doing something difficult and you want to be excellent at it, the odds of you failing to do so along the way are really high, and you have to learn to deal with it. And that's just how it is. That's my take on it. So I hope that helps. Keep sending me your questions and enjoy. All right, so there we go, wrapping it up. New episode of the Fighter Pilot Professor. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you learned a little bit about NATO. It's a unique organization and frankly, a very important one. And I enjoyed my time working there. And then I hope you learned a little bit about failing and why I think that failing is such an important part of learning and success. Keep sending me your questions, and I hope you have a great day.